Hello, my name is Mike Crane, author of Nature Snowdonia. I'd like to welcome you to this episode of Upland Lives. I try to offer opportunities for further training and CPD for mountain leaders and mountaineering instructors. And as part of that, I think it's good to get to know some of the other people who are working in our hills, operating on our hills. And in this case, this week, looking after ourselves, because one of our very special guests this week is Elvin Jones. And Elvin is the Access and Conservation Officer for the BMC in Wales, the British Mountaineering Council in Wales. Elvin is Welsh. He's a first language Welsh speaker. He hails from Blaenau Ffestiniog. He walks, climbs, mountaineers. He's a qualified mountain leader himself. He's also a mountain rescue volunteer, busy with the Llanberis team. That's when I tend to see him most, out there on Snowdon. But he's also a qualified countryside manager. He's worked for national parks. He's worked for the National Trust. He's been the land manager for the Carnarvon. He is a son of a farmer, a sheep farmer. His brother still works at farm. And his mother's from a slate quarrying background. So, you know, you can't get much more North Walian than that. So given that he's a climber too, and a pretty good one, he is our Access and Conservation Officer. I should throw in there as well, some people will be doing a podcast of this nature just because they're a cancer survivor. He's also a cancer survivor. So this week's Superman is Elvin Jones. Elvin, how are you today?
Da iawn, diolch, Mike. Diolch yn fawr iawn am y croeso yna. Thank you very much indeed for that welcome. And gosh, I hope I live up to some of those expectations.
Yeah, we'll see how we go. My stress is packing as much as I can into the time we've got available. So, Elvin, you're the Access and Conservation Officer for Wales. What does that mean, and why does Wales have its own Access and Conservation Officer?
Well, BMC does cover England and Wales, and we're here to represent members who live in Wales and also members who use Wales. The vast majority of BMC members will at some time or another come into Wales and enjoy our amazing hills and cliffs. There's nothing really worth climbing in England, is there? You know, the hills are barely, they're hills, not mountains, aren't they? So I think the issues in Wales are specifically Welsh, and with increased devolution and increased sort of powers being given to the Welsh Parliament, as it's now called, and most of the area of work that we cover in terms of access legislation, rules, regulations, etc. It's now done from Cardiff, basically. And, you know, the decisions made in Westminster have very little relevance to the countryside of Wales these days. So the need for have somebody in Wales to address these issues directly and represent our members from within Wales, that became apparent 10 years ago when you yourself assisted in setting up this job, Mike.
Yeah. Just help us out then. What sort of things, just give some examples of the sort of laws that are made in Cardiff now as opposed to Westminster. So, you know, if we're going to write to our MP, we're not going to write to our MP in Westminster about certain things in Wales. We're going to write to our member of the Senedd, is that correct, Cardiff?
Right.
So what would we write to our member of the Senedd about rather than our member of Parliament?
Well, the members of the Senedd, as you rightly say, Senedd is the Welsh Parliament, for those who might not be aware. They are now totally and fully responsible for huge areas of life in Wales, whether that's health, education, transport, and significantly for us, environment and recreation and sports. So, you know, the Welsh government has total say in those areas, including legislation. For us as hill walkers and climbers, the major piece of work is going to be debated early this year, probably in 2022, will be the review of access legislation in Wales, where we may well see an extension of what we have now, which is the Countryside and Lifestyle Way Act, which covers England and Wales. But here in Wales, that's being reviewed, and we may well see substantial changes in access legislation, something we in the BMC have been very much involved with for a number of years now, which hopefully will give us a right of access to the coast in the same way that we've got a right of access to the uplands at the moment.
That's incredible. So it's quite a busy time, isn't it? Because you've got that access legislation. You've also got changes to the way farms are supported as well. Will that come into anything we do in terms of access?
It will, very much so. we all know Brexit has happened and the way agricultural subsidies are being paid will change, and they are changing. In England, that's known as ELMS, which is the Environmental Land Management Scheme. In Wales, there's a separate Wales Agriculture Bill, which is being debated next year as well. And that will be the way that landowners and farmers are being paid. Now, in the past, that's mainly been based essentially on headage payments. So the more stock you get, the more you get paid, basically, which has always been the best sort of for the environment or best for biodiversity, especially in the uplands. That is now changing. And some of the products that were being paid for by governments now in Wales will possibly be looking at carbon, for instance, or maintaining peatland. There's a real drive to have much more woodland in Wales. There's going to be a lot more emphasis on the environmental outputs from farms, so clean water, clean air, clean soil, and the new agricultural benefit scheme will be paying for those. Collectively, they're often referred to as public goods, and one of those public goods, of course, is access. You know, there's no point having all this clean air, green space, if we can't actually get to it and use it and enjoy it. And one of the aspects of that new agriculture bill that we've been working on is to try and get access included in that, so that the landowners can get some sort of recompense if there is currently no access to those areas. But we also feel it's quite important that if we have a right of access there, as of right already, should actually people be paid for that? That should actually be as of right anyway, like public footpaths, open access land. That's already there, and it's really important to make that point that we don't lose what we've already got in the mix.
That's interesting. That, and of course, Elvin, you've got your brother's involved in this, isn't it? Do you talk to your brother about these things? Your brother being a sheep farmer, a hill farmer near Blenheim, do you have family? Do you have heated discussions, or do you have convivial discussions about climbers and farming and being on the hill? And
it's quite interesting because the arguments can be split in two, and I'm not avoiding that particular debate at all in answering this way. No, we have quite convivial sort of discussions about it, and actually we see eye to eye on most of these issues. It's quite interesting that the issue isn't about lights with many farmers, it's about behaviour. Yes. And I think sometimes there's too much emphasis on the rights. I've got a right to go here. Landowner says you haven't got a right to go here. If we focus more on the issues to do with behaviour rather than what the rights are, I think a lot of issues could be avoided.
Absolutely. It does amaze me how tolerant most of our farming community is as walking across the land, spending the day climbing on their land. I think they're really, really tolerant. So I quite understand that focus on behaviour. It's just fundamental. I think what's frustrating for us, and this might be something that comes in your job, is most of us have learnt the countryside code. We've learnt ways of behaving. Do you find yourself having to defend people going into the outdoors who are not necessarily from that background of a traditional hill walking, climbing bent, and are possibly not aware of how they should be behaving? Is that something that causes you some frustration when you're lobbying on our behalf?
Yes, I do see that, and there's different levels of it. You get people who are coming in who want to go to the outdoors, primarily from very urban areas of the United Kingdom, and a lot of those people are completely unaware and ignorant, in the best possible sense of the word ignorant, of behaviour and also safety issues as well, and how to dress, how to, you know, just lack of experience they've got in accessing the countryside, because it's not part of the education curriculum anymore. They're in urban areas and the focus is on passing exams and getting grades rather than actually teaching people skills. As an ex-teacher, I'm sure you'll sort of understand that, Mike. Yeah. So you get that aspect. You will get a minority who want to go everywhere and don't give a damn. You know, you're going to get a small percentage. And most landowners can deal with that and cope with that. But equally, you've got landowners who just do not want people on their land, full stop, you know, for whatever historical prejudice. They own the land, they don't want people on it. Yeah. And you will always get a few of them as well. Unfortunately, sometimes we tend to focus too much on where the minority who want to do everything, go everywhere without giving a damn, to butt up against a few landowners who don't want any of us on that land either. And you know, those are the hot spots, really. Thankfully, they are few and far between in the main. But what we found, of course, in the last 2 years, COVID, Brexit, all the rest of it, I think society is far more polarised. And also we've had volumes of visitors that we've probably never had before into the countryside, which is fantastic. On the one hand, we get people enjoying our countryside here.
It's been a difficult time, and I'd like to think it'll settle down a bit next year. We'll have a much more realistic idea next year of how many of those people return and how many don't return. But gosh, if those messages about behaviour aren't getting out now, I'm not sure what else we can do.
I think the messages are clear enough. I think we do have issues with how we get the messages to people. I think we need to be looking more at the vehicle for getting information to people. Social media is definitely the way, one of the ways to do that. You know, increasingly, that's how people get their advice. That's how they get their information. And we are finding that really short video excerpts of, you know, 1 minute, 2 minute long video snippets are the way to get information through to people these days.
Yeah, short attention spans. We've got into some quite heavy stuff already there, and clearly I think the enormity of what you're doing is pretty obvious to people there. So I just want to rewind a little bit and find out how you come to be doing what you're doing. So first of all, Elvin, how do you come to be a climber? You know, say you're brought up in a farming quarrying community in Blaenau Ffestiniog. Most climbers come from Manchester, don't they, or Sheffield, or these days maybe the Walls in London. How does a rural lad in North Wales get to be a climber?
Well, yeah, you know, when I was back in school, in the School of Moylwyn in Blaenau Ffestiniog, when I was into my climbing, I was probably regarded as being one of the weirdos because I hung out on cliffs and steep areas rather than wanted to play football or something. I saw people climbing when we were gathering sheep and sort of just helping out, you know, sort of, you know, in my very early years, really 10, 11 years of age. And I thought, that looks interesting. So I had a bit of a go at it myself and took one of these sort of one of the ropes off the hay barn and sort of used that to sort of, you know, hang over a little cliff that was above the house. And I think my parents thought I better sort of, I'm going to kill myself if I do that by myself. So one of my uncles, or two of my uncles, in fact, were very keen climbers, which is unusual. They were from Postmadog and members of the Club Glyngor Postmadog Climbing Club. And when I was 11, they took me out climbing. One of them took me out climbing onto Upper Tir Trimadog. I think I was 11 years of age.
Wow.
And I was addicted from then on in, really. I just really got into it.
Yeah, you were hooked.
And at the time in Blaenau, there wasn't a climbing club as such, but there was a little mountain rescue team called the Moylwyn Rescue Team.
Oh, yeah.
I think they called out about once a year at the most, if that. Yeah. And it was essentially a climbing club, and they were really good in that they were climbers and regular hill walkers, and they taught me an awful lot of the skills, you know, that I needed, really.
I think Blaenau is really interesting because it is a rock city, isn't it? It really is. You know, not just a slate quarrying, but it's just covered in natural outcrops of rock of all sizes and shapes. Why isn't it a global centre for rock climbing? It looks amazing when you pass through.
It's a good question, actually, because personally, I might be biased in this, but it's the best quality rock in North Wales. I think the quality of the stuff in the Moylwynion is so much better than the stuff in the past, you know? The new guidebook that's come out, the Climbers Club have just produced a new guidebook to the Moylwynion and Cymshedw, and I think it's, for the first time ever, it's done it justice with some wonderful photographs, and you know, the team involved, Pete Johnson, put it together. I think it's a real credit to the team involved in that, and hopefully it'll draw a bit of attention there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that. Does it cover the bouldering and a lot of the little crags as well?
It does cover the bouldering as such, and I'm really pleased to see that in Blaenau now. There's a local sort of youth scene there called Hongyan, which is Welsh for hanging, and there's a whole bunch of really good local lads and lasses who are really into bouldering and climbing there. And they, you know, they're climbing properly hard stuff and enjoying it. And they're local Welsh people with Welsh names for the boulders and Welsh using the Welsh names for the areas. And I think it's brilliant to see local people getting involved in it. Yeah, I've always got a tale. I've got a tale, you know, from when I was a youngster, when I was into some mountaineering and climbing, and I was passionate about the outdoors from an early age, and I always wanted to work in the outdoors. And I met a careers teacher from the local authority. They didn't have them in the school at that time. I must have been about 17, 16 or 17. I was already well into my climbing quite sort of decent grades at the time. And I was asked what I wanted to do as a career. And I said I was keen to be an instructor, a guide, work in the outdoors, anything like that, because of my passion for the outdoors. The advice I was given, and I hope it'll be different these days, is that local people don't do that sort of thing. That's for people from the outside. You'd be better off going to work in a bank, Kelvin, so you can have lots of money to travel, or become a teacher so you can have time off to travel.
Oh, my goodness.
That was the careers advice was given.
That's terrifying.
It is. But as with many things in life, I ignored it.
Yeah, well done. We did speak to Tracy from the Outdoor Partnership in an early Upland Lives, and she's doing a lot of work on getting more local people involved in the outdoors. Really good work, Tracy Evans, that is. And if there's any consolation, where I was brought up, and you said you were into the outdoors, you were told to join the army, and I didn't quite see the connection between guns and being in the outdoors. So I did end up as an outdoor instructor, but you chose to be a countryside manager. Where did that come from?
I'm not quite sure exactly. It's almost by accident in one sense, in that my A levels didn't quite go as well as they should have the first time around. And by the time I resat them, I was really considering what my future was and which direction I wanted to go in. I'd already dabbled doing a bit of outdoor instruction at some of the local outdoor centres in the Ffestiniog area, which I enjoyed, but I wasn't convinced it's what I wanted to do every day. Yeah. And the opportunity came up. There was an embryonic sort of course at Bangor, what is now Bangor University, Bangor Normal College then, in countryside management. And I was offered a place on that course after I finally resat my A-levels. And I went on it and I sort of completed that course. And it was a real eye-opener to me. And I realised that, you know, outdoor countryside management is actually a career in itself. And there were real skills involved in it. And it was wonderful. And it led me to I worked in the slate quarries for a while to pay off student debts and all the rest of it.
Right.
And I was so fortunate then to get my first proper job down in Pembrokeshire, working for the Pembrokeshire Coast National Park as a park ranger in North Pembrokeshire, which is amazing in the 1980s to be down there then.
Yeah, it was a good time. So you were climbing a lot, presumably, as well.
It was just the place to be. Pembrokeshire was developing, you know. Every time I went out for a walk in the North Pembrokeshire coast, I wouldn't just find new climbs to find. I would find complete sections of cliffs that had never been touched before.
Yeah.
And there was a whole bunch of people that I remained good friends with to this day who were also based there at that time. You know, people like Steve Quentin, Paul Donnithorne, Emma, people like that.
Oh, yeah. So you started off looking at the National Park, you moved to the National Trust, and then you brought everything together by getting the job at the BMC. So you were an established climber and mountaineer. You climbed around the world, I believe, and you were countryside manager. So those skills were sought after by the BMC, and you've never looked back since being in the BMC.
Well, quite. It was, you know, I loved the job I did at the National Trust. It was there for nearly 20 years.
Gosh.
And originally as a warden ranger, and then gradually, you know, things developed and I became a manager, a property manager. And then I just realised one day I was managing several offices, holiday cottages, commercial interests, human resource, budgets, you name it. And I was scratching my head thinking, when did I actually get out to see some of this amazing landscape I'm supposed to be managing? And the post came up with the BMC at that time. And it was significantly different. And it was something that was a new challenge and it was time to do something different. And I was given a lot of freedom in the early days of the job, you know, to develop it really in the direction I wanted to, with support from some incredible volunteers that the BMC has got, you know, across the whole country. You know, I'm just in awe of some of the work done by volunteers for the BMC, without whom I think it would be a much, much poorer organisation, a much less effective organisation. And it was a joy to be able to do that job and to cover the whole of Wales as well, and not just one specific area of Wales.
I mustn't omit that you were actually BMC volunteer as well at the time. You've been using your professional expertise for the BMC for a long time before you worked for the BMC, didn't you? And I think you still do some volunteering. Do you, knowing about how the National Parks work, how the National Trust works, presumably that helps you enormously when you're having conversations on behalf of the BMC around access and conservation?
I think it does. Yeah, lots of organisations have a certain culture and a certain way of working, and they have some sort of ingrained sort of bias possibly against certain activities sometimes. And having been on the inside, it's quite interesting. Most people are sort of poacher turned gamekeeper in one sense, and I'm quite the reverse of it really, in that I'm probably more of a gamekeeper turned poacher. But I think I like to think about some professional elements to the work we do at the BMC, and I'd already had an awful lot of networks and contacts through working for the different organisations. And I think having that background and understanding of why a land manager might have concerns for liability, or why they might have concerns about landscape issues of, you know, a climbing rope left hanging overnight or something, or some issues to do with parking, or that bit of ivy that we need to strip off to go climbing on, actually that might be quite an important habitat. And coming at it from that background with that knowledge, I think has eased some of the discussions with the more difficult landowners, especially the larger landowners and the organisations we deal with.
Yeah, and of course you get together with those landowners to try and talk to Welsh Government, I believe. So when I go walking in Snowdonia, most of the people I see are walkers. I don't see many other people on the hills. So if walkers are, and climbers are the major land users in North Wales in particular, how are they represented to Welsh Government and to those other bodies? Is that your role, or do you work with the Ramblers Cymru to do that? How does all that work?
Up to now, I was the only officer here in Wales. Of course, now we've employed, I've got a colleague based in Cardiff now as well, who works more on the policy side of it, which I think is a real step forward again for the BMC. We've come a long way in that 10 years.
It's good.
It is indeed a good thing. And getting representation and getting our voice heard demands having credibility as well, and having status and certain gravitas. If we just turn up in a glossy van, you know, sort of just want to go climbing on your land, mate, and, you know, that's what I'm going to do, we're not going to go very far with that attitude.
Yeah.
You know, climbing is important. It's important financially, it's important economically, but it's also important to get people out to enjoy spaces for its own sake as well. I think it's really important that.
Yeah.
And we know after COVID, the mental health values of being outdoors is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And being able to represent those views at a senior level in government is really important. Otherwise, our voice is quite weak. And I think as a sector, our voice has been weak for very many years at government level here in Wales. But it's much stronger when we work in collaboration with other organisations. We've got very good links with the Ramblers here in Wales. We set up a thing called the Outdoor Alliance, which is an alliance of all the outdoor sort of activity, sort of bodies, representatives in Wales, so we can speak with one voice really when we go into government. So we're not sort of a disparate bunch of individuals. And I think between us, we must represent, even within Wales, you know, hundreds, if not millions of people.
That's brilliant. That sounds like really, in fact, one of my questions will be sort of challenges and rewards in your job. And, you know, I don't want to dwell on the challenges, because that would get a bit dull, really, with disposable barbecues, dogs and that sort of thing. Would this increase in representation for the outdoor sector be one of your best achievements? You know, if you were to say what's been brilliant about being the BMC's officer in Wales over the last 10 years, what sort of things would stand out to you?
Standout moments have been, I think when we managed to get things like the then Minister for Sports and Culture out to Gogarth to see what the issues were with access.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big step forward. You know, and we had the RSPB on board with us at that meeting, supporting us. quite early on in this job, we had a couple of receptions at the Senedd where we had politicians turning up and people from other outdoor bodies. We're mentioned in government reports now. We're not an aside. We're not just some organisation to off to one side. We're consulted when there are major changes to legislation. Now, those are big successes.
Yeah.
But equally for the climber and walker on the ground, I think equally good successes are the fact that we can actually go climbing to the Orms. You know, nobody's stopping us going climbing in the Sweat Quarries in Dinarlaig. Nobody's stopping us climbing in the sea cliffs of Pembrokeshire. We've got all these agreements in place that are very subtle and they just seem to happen, but they happen because there's a lot of work gone into it and a lot of agreements and a lot of hard work by volunteers as well as staff to make them happen and make them work.
It's a good story, Elfin. I just want to come back to you as well, because we've drifted off to policy and government, which is so easy to do. You volunteer for the mountain rescue. How on earth do you find time to be a mountain rescuer as well as go climbing? And I know you do biking and all this work you're doing. How do you do that? How do you have time for that?
It's 24 hours in every day, isn't it, Mike? I've got to do something with it, you know. it's something I've always done. I got involved in rescue when I was quite young, as I mentioned at the beginning. It's one of the ways I got involved in the more formal side of climbing and hill walking. And I just felt I've always wanted to give something back into it, really. I've enjoyed the medical part of mountain rescue. I've always enjoyed learning more about sort of the mountain medicine type aspects of it. And here in Llanberis, there's plenty of opportunity, you know, being the busiest, one of the busiest mountains in the world, arguably. And inevitably, you know, there's going to be people who, when things go awry or go amiss occasionally. And we're a busy team with about 200 plus incidents each year. And we're a bunch of climbers, hill walkers. You know, every one of us is an active sort of hill goer. And it could be any of us who get injured. You know, and we're loath to sort of criticise anybody who has an adventure that goes wrong. And you know, it's nice to be able to give something back in that way. And it's also quite exciting, you know, when there's nothing on the television and you get a phone beeps at you and then 30 minutes later you're hanging out of the door of a helicopter, £30 million helicopter being winched onto Creeb Goch.
I think that's really interesting you mentioned that, because you've been at pains to point out before that the hordes of people heading up Chwyddfa Snowdon in flip-flops are not necessarily the ones who you're rescuing. It's a spread across all hill users, and any of us could slip at any particular time. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are avoidable incidents.
Yes.
A little bit more preparation. And that preparation goes for experienced climbers as well as sort of the inexperienced as well at times. But an actual accident, a trip, a slip can happen to any of us. And I think, you know, with the sheer volume of people using Snowdon, you know, approaching 1 million people a year now, probably in this area, and we get called out 200 times a year as a rescue team.
Yeah.
It's not a lot, is it, really, when you think about
it? It's a tiny amount. Another aspect of the mountain rescue is, you know, you're often lauded as heroes in the press, and I know some of you find that a little bit uncomfortable. If we just talk about that cave rescue that was in South Wales. Fortunately, you know, the guy involved was an experienced caver and he had an unfortunate slip and he's okay, I believe. I'm actually quite envious of being part of that team that conducted that rescue. That organisation, that adventure, that camaraderie, that teamwork, that must be pretty good on a big rescue.
The teamwork is phenomenal. You know, a bunch of individuals who may not otherwise sort of meet up, suddenly get together at very, very short notice and occasionally put themselves in danger, but they shouldn't really be doing that, and go out and help somebody. And yeah, the camaraderie, the goodwill you get afterwards from that, it makes it worthwhile. It's incredible.
Mm.
Having said that, you know, I've been a critic of mountain rescue and it always will be at times as well. You know, the red jacketed male, middle-aged beard, Red Sox brigade, and being a bit, you know, there's a history maybe of people venturing into the outdoors being criticised by, you know, rescuers who are well-intentioned but may not be mountaineers themselves. And sometimes the messaging that Mountain Rescue gives out needs to be quite careful. I'm an absolute supporter of the right for people to take an informed risk and to go for an adventure. And adventure will go wrong by its very meaning. You know, its outcome is not known. That's why it's an adventure. And we need to be very careful as mountain rescuers that we remain steadfastly in support of that ethos.
Yeah, I think that's great. That they are all separate teams, aren't they? It's a slightly weird organisation in that sense.
It is. I think each team has got its own individual expertise and its area that it covers, and possibly its different operating sort of ethos, if you like. Yeah. Because I think generally in North Wales, I think most of the teams are sort of, they're made up of people who are passionate climbers and hill walkers. Yeah. And the last thing we would want any form of restriction on access or some sort of formal safety instruction that's needed before you can go onto the hills.
Yeah, we need that freedom. Because as you say, the accidents are tiny numbers compared to the numbers actually going on the hill, aren't they?
They are. I haven't got the figures for North Wales to hand, but certainly on Wyddfa, Snowdon, the Llanberis area, which covers everything, you know, from all the way down to an old lady who might slip in a garden in Carnarvon and the ambulance can't get to her, all the way to somebody who might sort of be soloing on Cloggy. We cover a wide sort of remit, and we get 200 incidents a year, which, you know, it sounds a lot, and it is a lot, but when you're given the numbers of people in the area, it's actually not that much, really.
Yeah, that's interesting, that. But of course, we're lucky to have you with us as well. We're not just lucky to have you because of your background and knowledge and experience, but, you know, you've been quite poorly as well, haven't you? Do you want to tell us about that? I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's... an adventure I didn't sign up to. It's a journey I wasn't sort of prepared to go on, but I ended up going on. As you know, it's gosh 6 years ago or so. I got quite ill with some rather nasty pains in the abdomen, and it took the medical people quite a long time to fathom out what was wrong with me. I think the psychiatrists are still trying to work out what was wrong with me, by the way. But the medical doctors were struggling. I had various things wrong with me, and I was very, very ill. And it turns out I had sort of a stage 2C seminoma, which is a form of testicular cancer, which had spread and it had gone into my abdomen with a rather large, nasty tumour in there. And once that was diagnosed and several operations later, and had sort of several months of chemotherapy, and and that was sort of 5 years ago. In fact, 5 years ago this month, I think I finished my chemotherapy, and I made a very good recovery. You know, it changes your attitude to life. Surviving cancer is one thing. Survivorship in cancer is a topic in itself. Some people struggle with the survivorship in itself, and I'm very, very fortunate as some very good friends are not as so fortunate as me, which is quite sad. But it makes you realize that each day is a bit of a gift, really. This sounds a bit trite, that, but it's very true. None of us know what's around the corner, and it certainly changes your outlook on life and what's important in life. Some people go for the bucket lists, and you know, they want to go to Machu Picchu, they want to go to Everest Base Camp, or jump naked out of an aeroplane at 20,000 feet or whatever tickles their fancy. But I found for me, it was actually enjoying what's around my home area. It was enjoying the hills here. It was spending time with friends. It's the little things, whether it's nipping to the pass for an evening climb, whether it's having an afternoon off and a quiet day and going up a quick cheeky solo up a route on Trevan, or nipping out to Gogarth for a bit of climbing in the sunshine. It was doing that. Suddenly the grade was far less important, and being out there doing it with good people in good places was far, far more important.
Yeah, I recognise that. Those are the special things, and we do live in an amazing place for it. So you're a bit of an optimistic chap. But there are challenges for our hills, aren't there? How would you like to see things change and develop in the uplands, particularly in North Wales? And you could compare that with the Lake District or Scotland. You know, how would you like to see things move forward?
I think land management is the fundamental change. Is how is the land managed? How is it treated? We can't keep on taking and taking and taking from the hills. And that includes recreationally as well. Climate change is here and it's having an impact. We have used the hills for a large number of years by overstocking, overusing certain places. How we manage that going forward is a huge challenge. I think it's really important to retain the culture, the communities, and the language of an area like North Wales, particularly. But equally, those issues are important, whether it's in the Lake District or Yorkshire or sort of Dartmoor as well. We're seeing a big shift at the moment of people from urban areas wanting to live in the countryside. People know it's a nice place to live, and they don't have to work from big offices anymore. But I think there's a danger of swamping the countryside with that. And even the outdoor community moving into Snowdonia at times has a big impact, an inadvertent impact possibly. But villages are suddenly full of sort of lovely sort of Volkswagen transporter camper vans rather than people going to work in the local factory or the quarry or something. And while that incoming audience is healthy to a certain extent, when it takes over what's already there in a local community that may already be there, the impact is tremendous. And then you have a new community, a dual community forming, and it often takes over and sort of swamps the existing community, which makes the existing community feel very defensive and then possibly react in a defensive way against sort of incomers and against sort of outdoor activities possibly as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I do go to great lengths to point out to many visitors that the fabric of the community is often within the farming community, and it's the farming community that volunteer for Parent Teachers Association, the local council, the local access forum, and the outdoor community probably need to step up to the plate a little bit more and volunteer for some of those organisations, and not just the BMC, which is also a good thing to volunteer for. Would that be an accurate depiction?
I think I agree with you with a lot of those issues. When people move into an area, when we're a community, an outdoor community like we are, and I straddle a lot of these communities, I'm not quite sure which community I fit into. I don't like pigeonholing anybody really. I think it's getting this, being part of a community is what's important rather than taking over a community. It's having respect for what's already been there and trying not to be in competition with what's already there. And so it's not seen as something that's like it's not an aggressive takeover, which I think is how it's seen by some communities possibly.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I can see that, actually. Elvin, we're coming towards the end of our time now, and one of our main audiences here is mountain leaders and mountaineering instructors. Would there be anything that you'd like them to be better informed about or better able to help with? What advice would you give to people who are bringing people into our hills and onto our crags and looking after them there? What would you like them to be talking to their customers about?
I think it's this understanding, which then leads to a bit of respect about why people's approach to it is different. That wasn't that clearly explained. People might be coming here, they're landing in a minibus, they're head to toe in very expensive Gore-Tex and rucksacks, and they're going to be sort of walking across somebody's land. And they don't pay for that. They may well pay for the experience of being taught, they pay for the skills they're being taught, but they're not paying for the actual access. And I firmly believe that access should be free. But I think a bit of respect that it is somebody else's land, whatever people might feel about land ownership and the history of that and the politics of it. But I think having that respect that we're on somebody else's land, somebody else earns a living, somebody else pays taxes on this land, They also, in some cases, they also in receipt of government's money, of course, for that land as well. And a little bit of understanding from both sides would be really useful. Somebody going through a gate leaves a gate open. I've left the gate open. Why is the farmer so annoyed with me? You might not be the only person who's left the gate open that day. You might be the 100th person who's left that damn gate open that day. Yeah. And that's the 100th time he's had to go out and get his sheep off the A5 or something, which is then he then gets prosecuted for because it's damaged the car or something. So it's understanding that there are other issues behind some of the people are annoyed. Yeah.
Really important. It's a shared space, isn't it? That's one of the aims of this podcast, is to talk to some of the other people who share that space with us. Elvin, I'm going to bring it to a close there. Is there anything else you would like to say before I say thank you and goodbye?
No, I think people need to be kind to each other in the outdoors these days. It's a very confined space, the outdoor these days. It seems to be getting smaller and smaller and with more and more people. And I think we really need to understand each other's issues. And we need to think about how we can give something back and share that space and just generally be a bit kinder to each other when we're in that space.
Wise words and a wonderful note to finish on. Diolch yn fawr, Elvin Jones, pnawn da.
Croeso, pnawn da, Mike.